What's the first impression you have of a new place? Is it the first meal you eat? The first time you have an ice cream cone? The first person you meet? The first night you spend in your new bed in your home? The first broken promise? The first time you realize that no one cares about you as anything other than the potential bearer of sons? The recognition that your father-in-law, a man born in this country, has been so isolated in Chinatowns throughout his life that he speaks the most pathetic English ever. The moment you understand that everything you'd come to believe about your in-law's class, standing, prosperity, and fortune is as wrong as everything you thought about your natal family's status and wealth. What stays with me most are the feelings of loss, unsettlement, unease, and a longing for the past that cannot be relieved. This isn't just because my sister and I are new to this strange and foreign place. It's as though every person in Chinatown is a refugee. No one here is a Gold Mountain man, rich beyond imagining, not even Old Man Louis. On Angel Island, I learned about his ventures and the value of his merchandise, but they mean nothing here, where everyone is poor. People lost their jobs during the Depression. Those lucky enough to have families sent them back to China because it was cheaper to provide for them there than to feed and house them here. 5 years ago, in 1933, most of Chinatown was torn down to make room for a new railroad station, which is being built on that huge construction site we saw when Sam brought us here on the streetcar. People were given 24 hours to move, far less than what May and I had when we left Shanghai. But where could they go? The law says that Chinese can't own property, and most landlords won't rent to Chinese either. So people cram into buildings and squeeze into rooms in the last few buildings of the original Chinatown, where we live, or in the city market Chinatown, which caters to produce growers and sellers, many blocks and a culture away from here. Everyone, including me, misses their families in China. But when I pin the photographs that May and I brought with us on my bedroom wall, Yen Yen yells at me, "You stupid girl, you want to get us in trouble? What happens if the immigration inspectors come? How are you going to explain who those people are?" "They're my parents," I say, "and that's May and me when we were little. These things are not a secret." "Everything is a secret. You see pictures of anyone here? Now take those down and hide them before I throw them away." That's my first morning, and soon I discover that although I'm in a new land, in many ways, it's as though I've taken a giant step back in time.
Good evening, and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. You've been listening to a reading from a compelling new novel by Lisa C. The novel is Shanghai Girls, a book which is number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. I first became aware of Lisa's work when I read her book Snowflower and the Secret Fan about a little village in China where the women developed a language all their own that only they understood. Then I read On Gold Mountain, which is subtitled The 100-Year Odyssey of My Chinese-American Family. So obviously, Lisa C. is well-versed in not only the Chinese in America, but also in China. You may have read Peony in Love, which is a recent book. And then, of course, Lisa is the daughter of Carolyn C., who is much revered by those of us who read her work at the height of the women's movement and who treasure every word that she writes. So I'm delighted to have Lisa here in the studio, and she'll be talking with us about her work and particularly about Shanghai Girls. So stay with us. It's so good to have you here, Lisa.
It's so great to be here.
We really appreciate that you could make time in your schedule. You're on a book tour.
Yes, I am. I'm way into it now.
Well, we're delighted that you could be here at KRCB. We'll go right to the book, Shanghai Girls. Now, your choice of Shanghai is very, very important here because Shanghai is almost one of the characters in the book.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and I picked 1937 is when it starts. And Shanghai in 1937 was considered the Paris of Asia.
Oh.
It was a city of great contrasts and great diversity. You had this extraordinary wealth on one end and just unbelievable poverty on the other. And you had people who had literally come from all over the world to be in this Paris of Asia. You had the French who'd settled in the French concession, the British who were running things. You had white Russians who had escaped out of Russia during the revolution and had sought and found refuge in Shanghai. 1937, the first big wave of Jews coming out of Germany who had the sense that something bad is coming, and when no other country would take them and no other city would take them, Shanghai did. And of course, all the Chinese themselves. And so this was this final moment as the Paris of Asia before things took a real turn for the worse.
And looking back with the retrospect into history, we know what was about to happen, that the Japanese were just poised to invade, and that all of that culture and beauty and sophistication was coming to an end.
A very abrupt end.
Very abruptly.
You know, because, you know, first the Japanese invaded in August of 1937, and then the Sino-Japanese War rolled right into World War II. As soon as World War II was over, civil war. And then in 1949, Mao took over the country. And almost overnight, Shanghai went from being the Paris of Asia to being this very gray, very grim, very depressed city. And there it remained really until about the mid-1990s when there was this kind of renaissance.
Yes.
And today you could say that Shanghai is once again the Paris of Asia. Might be more accurate to say it's the New York of Asia. And by now it's probably the most accurate to say that New York is now the Shanghai of the rest of the world.
Yes. And it's probably the most important city in China because of that, maybe more important than Beijing.
Well, Beijing is, you know, historically the sort of political capital, and there is all of that. But Shanghai is the center of art, culture, commerce.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of China as a global economic superpower, you don't really think of Beijing. You think of Shanghai.
Yeah. And so you set your story in Shanghai, and it's a story of two sisters, Pearl and May. And they're young ladies in 1937 in Shanghai, and they're known as beautiful girls, mm-hmm. capital letters, capital mm-hmm. B, capital G.
Right.
The beautiful girls.
Right. Well, the beautiful girls, these were models for Shanghai advertising. And these young women, they were selling everything from matches to carburetors, from powdered baby's milk to cigarettes. And these posters, most of the beautiful girls posed for posters, so they were kind of like calendar girls. And they were selling this kind of new modern Chinese life. They weren't like their mothers. They weren't like their grandmothers. They didn't have bound feet. They were well-educated. They expected to marry for love and not go into arranged marriages. And so they were selling this kind of, you know, again, this kind of modern Chinese woman who was going to help transform the country. And so in these posters and calendars, you see these beautiful girls doing very modern things like playing golf, playing tennis, diving into pools, stepping off of airplanes and waving, driving sports cars.
Smoking,
dancing in nightclubs, drinking champagne.
Yeah. And they loved their life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because it was a very glamorous and fun life.
That's right. And yet their mother still had bound feet.
Yes.
in the old-fashioned way.
Right.
Yeah. I couldn't help but think about those bound feet when I was looking recently at fashions with those 5 and 6 inch heels that young women wear. I mean, that's almost as bad. Tripping around on those must be almost as uncomfortable as having bound feet.
Well, there's a slight difference, which
yes.
is your bones aren't broken.
Yes, you know? There's a slight difference, yes.
So bound feet, you know, the toes were broken, the bones in the midfoot were broken, and the foot was kind of rolled over, almost like you'd roll over a sock until all that was left for a woman to walk on was basically her big toe. And so the way to visualize an ideal-sized bound foot is just to look at your own thumb. It was about an inch wide and about 3 inches long. So while I could never wear those 5 or 6 inch heels, I still would rather wear those than have my feet bound.
Because you can always take your shoes off.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. But I thought it was a very good point you made as the novelist to include that recently
right.
that fashionable women still had bound feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, she was born in another time.
That's right.
But, you know, interestingly, so bound feet or foot binding was outlawed in 1912.
Oh.
But in some areas of China, it lingered. So in some places it lingered because it was such a remote area. They didn't hear about it. For one of the books I wrote on Snowflower and the Secret Fan.
Oh, yes.
That book takes place in a very remote area of China. And when I went there, I learned that they hadn't learned that foot binding had been outlawed. They hadn't learned that Mao had taken over the country. They didn't hear either thing until 1952. So there were some areas in China that were just so remote that the practice lingered.
That was a wonderful book also, Snowflower and the Secret Fan. I think that's the first of your books that I read. And I remember how excited we all were about the book to discover this group of women who had taken charge of their own lives
right.
and created their own language.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful book. I'm talking to Lisa C., the author not only of Snowflower and the Secret Fan, and Peony in Love, but also her latest book, Shanghai Girls. The two girls, Pearl and May, there's a point at which their mother tells Pearl how she happened to name her Pearl. She's called Pearl Dragon
mm-hmm.
because she was born in the year of the dragon?
Right. She's born in the year of the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there's a whole part about how she was, why she chose to name her daughter Pearl mm-hmm. and sort of the significance of the pearl and how the dragon plays with the pearl. But there are other aspects to how a pearl forms
yes.
and how Pearl's mother thinks about sex that sort of yes. ties in to that.
Yes. And then May is considered the more beautiful of the two,
mm-hmm.
but her mother said, oh, May's a sheep.
Mm-hmm. that she's born in the year of the sheep.
Born in the year of the sheep.
And actually, yeah. there are a lot of things about people who are born in the year of the sheep. They love to be taken care of. They
yes.
love, they're kind of homebodies in a way.
Yes.
They have a real affinity for clothes and fine things and
yeah.
ruffles and laces and trimmings mm-hmm. because they like to be taken care of and they have this kind of vanity about them.
Yes. And you developed so skillfully the relationship between the two sisters,
mm-hmm.
the very, very strong bonds of love between them, and also the ways in which they were different, the ways in which they had serious, serious problems with one another
mm-hmm.
throughout the book. And I thought that enriched the plot.
Mm-hmm.
They're such interesting women.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The sibling relationship is typically the longest one we'll have in our lifetimes. Your parents die. You may not meet your significant other until you're pretty well into your 20s, even 30s, 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Your children will outlive you. So typically, the mm-hmm. sibling relationship is the longest
mm-hmm.
and in many ways the most complicated
mm-hmm.
because,
yeah.
you know, let's take sisters. So sister is someone who's known you since birth, who should love you, stand by you, support you, no matter what. And yet it's also your sister who knows exactly where to drive the knife to hurt you the most. And of course, you know exactly where to drive the knife to get her back. And so this is to me, just this very interesting relationship. And I did a lot of research, just sort of the standard kinds of research that one would do. I am a sister myself, so I've lived through a lot of that. I'm one of four. And then I also talk to a lot of women who have sisters. I join a lot of book clubs by speakerphone. And often at the end of the book club, you know, I would say, well, before we get off the phone, can I ask you a question or two about sisters? And I learned these unbelievable things. Oh. But one of the things that really has struck me, whether it's, you know, just in my family or I see it in other families, is how there are certain things we all agree on. There's the tall one and the short one. There's the skinny one, the one we say, oh, you know, she's short-waisted. There's the smart one and the one you say, oh, she's so sweet, meaning she can't do long division. That would have been me and my family. You know, and there are all these things, the athletic one, the couch potato, the generous one, the stingy one, mom's favorite, dad's favorite. And some of these things are true. You know, some of these things are actually accurate. And a lot of it is just stuff we kind of make up in our minds and we all kind of go along with. And that has always been really interesting to me, first as a sister myself, but then later as a mother. And I actually have sons, but to see how my sons will have all these things that they think about, you know, where we sit at the table. And I use that actually in Shanghai Girls in the very first chapter, that Pearl has this idea of who's loved the most by who sits where. And my sons, I got that from them because they have this whole story made up in their minds about where we sat all these years and what it means.
Do you have a story like that in your mind about your sisters, about where you sat?
No, I don't in my mind, at least for sitting, but there were certain other kinds of things where it was like, oh, yes, you know, Catherine is the most adored and Clara is the smart one.
Yes.
And I was the one who was bad at math and I was a little moody. And, you know, I mean, we all had these sort of characteristics that were assigned to us that some of it was accurate and some of it wasn't at all.
And some we assign to ourselves.
Exactly.
Yes. And there's always a comparison.
Always a comparison.
You see yourself in comparison to your sisters.
Right. And so one of the things with Shanghai Girls is, you know, it's told from Pearl's point of view.
Yes.
And you only hear her point of view.
That's right.
And every once in a while, May will speak up and say some things where she says, no, I saw it differently, but it really isn't until the end. Where all of a sudden, you know, there is an argument. I don't think that doesn't really give anything away to
right.
say that there's this argument. And then you see all these things from a completely different perspective from how May saw it. And May looked at everything completely different way. Now, some of it, well, my mother said, about May. She said, well, she'll just say anything to get her way. But other people have said to me, you know, I just wanted May to say those things because it was so true. And I just kept waiting for her to say this. And I think sometimes it depends for readers, like, were they sisters or were they the oldest sister or the younger sister? How they read that argument.
A climactic scene.
Mm-hmm. It is
and
a climactic
scene. We won't
scene.
Give away the plot. I promise
no.
you.
And
I
we
promise
won't, you
know, people
the things
out
that
there,
are
we
revealed
won't tell
there.
You.
But, but when I was writing
yes.
the book, I kept a list next to a piece of paper next to the computer, and every place where I thought May would have a different idea of what something meant, or I wrote it down. And so when it came time for that argument, I had this whole list. Now, I didn't use everything, but I don't know about you. But you know how sometimes you can get in an argument with a sister or your mother or your husband, and it's about something that happened today, but all of a sudden you're bringing in this stuff that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago.
The whole
and so,
thing.
You know, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's something so minor, but it's,
yes.
it, you know, that happened
yes.
way back.
Right.
But it's like a little burr,
yes.
you know, that's just been irritating you
that's
all
right.
these years, and you always pull it out.
That's right.
And so that, to me, was what uh-huh. happens in that argument,
yes.
where May just, it's like, there's the thing that they're arguing about, but it's really they're arguing about a lifetime. Of things that they've seen differently.
And when you do that, you can't stop yourself.
Right.
If
oh,
you
I know.
Start on that tirade,
oh, I know.
It's Katie bar the door. And,
yeah.
and that was apparent in the way that you wrote that scene, mm-hmm. that May, I felt, was a little astonished at herself, mm-hmm. but she couldn't stop.
Yeah, she couldn't stop
And
herself.
It was so, I mean, they were wounding each other. Mm-hmm. That was a magnificent scene.
Yeah, that was very, it was hard, but it was also so easy to write because, you know, I can just tell talking to you now that you've had arguments like that.
Oh, certainly.
So I think we all have. And so I was able to draw on what that's where you think, oh, I don't want to say this. I don't want. And then it's out of your mouth before you can even stop yourself. Mm-hmm. And it is that sense of wounding and wounding and wounding. Yeah. And it's a terrible battle.
It is. And it feels like a killer instinct. I mean, it's terrible to feel out of control like that.
And I think one of the things when I talk to all of these women who mm-hmm. had sisters, sometimes you hear, oh, no, we're just best friends and we've never had an argument. A woman told me that just the other day. We've never had a single argument. And I just think, okay, you're crazy, but all right.
Either that or just wait.
Yeah, or just wait.
You better have one soon.
Yeah. But I've also heard from so many women who've said, I haven't spoken to my sister in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. One woman, 40 years, when I was doing the research. And now since then, since the book came out, I've met another one, 40 years. And one of the things that I said to that first one, I said, well, after 40 years, you must not even feel like your sister's anymore. And, you know, you don't even have to think about her, right? And she said, no, of course I do, because sisters are for life. And I just think that sense of sisters are for life, that's what makes it different than friends, you know, even your best friend, which sometimes is a much better relationship mm-hmm. than you have with your sisters. The difference is a sister is for life. And that can be a blessing, but it's also can also be a curse.
Mm-hmm. And Pearl and May, because of the circumstances of this story, spend their entire life, these 20 years that you write of, together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are hardly ever separated
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes this relationship even more intense.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. you know, they both come to the United States in arranged marriages. They're
yes.
married to these a pair of brothers.
Yes.
And that was actually something that was pretty common, not just here in immigrant families, but also in China, because it was a way, you know, with arranged marriages mm-hmm. to it where often you were married out to another village or another town, and you might not ever see your family again. And so if sisters could marry into a family together, they would at least be together for the rest of their lives. And again, that's either a blessing or a curse, but it's better than not having anyone.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it was a way that women were able to survive a lot of hardship. And even, you know, the other aspect is Chinese families, especially in those days, they lived together multiple generations in
yes.
a family. So
yes.
often even sisters-in-law would become very, very close mm-hmm. because they lived in the same house together. Mm-hmm. And they also had one common enemy, the mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. the sisters came to America after a very, very hazardous, perilous journey, very mm-hmm. exciting, and ended up in Angel Island,
mm-hmm.
which is described as the Ellis Island of the West Coast. You must have done a great deal of research about Angel Island.
Well, I have, and it wasn't just for Shanghai Girls. My first book is about my family, the Chinese side of my family. And so when I was doing that research, and that's now 20 years ago, I was able to find all of these files at the National Archive Holding Facility here in San Bruno is where they had all of the Angel Island papers. And so they had found about 500 pages of interrogations, boarding passes, health certificates, photographs of my family.
Of your family.
And so it was just an incredible find. I mean, just an incredible thing. And even just something like the photographs. My family was very poor. Yeah. They were a poor immigrant family. So when the book came out, we had, you know, a book signing, but for the family. And people, they were my relatives, so they were very nice. They came through, they'd buy one book. And then I'd see them in the sort of over in the corners in the bookstore looking through, and I'd used a lot of photos. And they'd say, oh my God, here's a photo of me as a baby. There isn't another photo of me until I went into the Army. Or here's a photo of my mother. We don't even own a photo anywhere of my mother. But the government had taken them at Angel Island. And so those things were there for me to find. And it was just this incredible thing that I had found. And when I wrote On Gold Mountain, I only used just a fraction of that material. So when it came time to write Shanghai Girls, I used one of the files that I hadn't used before, that was the wife of a paper merchant who worked with my great-grandfather. So there were paper sons, but also paper merchants, because that was one of the four categories of Chinese who could come into the country. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, I used some of that almost verbatim of the actual experience of a real woman who came through Angel Island.
One of the surprising things, well, first of all, the government saved all of that. But then that material comes back to haunt the two sisters when the FBI is tracing them for something that you'll have to read the book to find out about. And the FBI has all this information from Angel Island.
That's right.
And the sisters are simply astonished that the government has hung on to those records of interrogation.
Well, I don't mean to sound paranoid or anything, but of course the government still does that. You know, they're collecting information about us all the time.
That's correct.
And they're not going to throw it out. I mean, they don't throw it out. That's not what the government does. They keep it and they put it in an archive. And so in the way that I've been able to do research about my family or the experience of the Chinese in America, there are going to be people in 50 years or 100 years from now who will be able to do research about all of us sitting here in this room right now, because the government keeps these records and then they're there for other people to look at years down the line.
It was your great-great-grandfather?
It was first my great-great-grandfather came to work on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, that's right.
And then my great-grandfather came and stayed, and he became the kind of Godfather Patriarch of Los Angeles Chinatown.
Of Los Angeles Chinatown. Gold Mountain starts coming back to me as you speak of this. And, you know, if the title hadn't already been used, you could have called this A Tale of Two Cities, because not only Shanghai is extremely important to it, and then you give us this wonderful, it's like we're living in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. I felt like, oh, that's what it's like. Oh, that's where it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started to get it. How it would be, you know, the families clustered there and having menial jobs and having to do so much. And these beautiful girls, capital letters, beautiful girls, are sweeping floors, washing pots and pans, doing all the dirty jobs that had to be done. What an amazing development in their lives.
Right. Well, again, it sounds like so much of this is coming from my own family, and it really isn't, because it's certainly not about my family. But I was able to take some of the experiences of people in my family and use them. So my great uncle back in 1932, for example, he went back to China and got all of his sons' wives. And one of the selling points to them, these were young women, beautiful women who had servants, they were well off. And so the selling point was, you're marrying a Gold Mountain man, you know, someone who's in America, who's, you know, this is a Gold Mountain man. It was like this wonderful, incredible idea that you were going to marry this really wealthy man living in America. And yet, when these young women came, here they'd had servants in China, but now they really lived like servants. And they literally didn't get out of their houses and apartments. I mean, they literally just lived inside for most of their lives. And so I know, for example, my great-grandfather, when he was in his 60s, he brought over a 16-year-old bride. And she only died a few years ago. But she never left the apartment until he died. And so from the time she was 16 until she was 40, she had never been outside except for weddings and funerals and one-month birthdays. Never outside, not to do shopping, not for anything. And some of these other women that, you know, were brought over by my great-great-uncle, these women, again, they weren't allowed out. And so here it is, 70 years later, and they may, you know, only a couple of them still living now, of course, but may speak about 10 words of English. So that experience, I think, was something that I don't think many people have read about or really are even aware of, that that kind of thing happened here. And one of the reasons for that is that in China, in Taiwan, on the mainland, in Hong Kong, life was evolving and changing. And especially for women, life was really evolving and changing. But here in American Chinatowns, what was it that people had to hold on to? They had their culture and they had their tradition. And so while things were changing in their home countries, here people held on to things so tightly. And one of the things that they really held on to was how they treated women.
We're going to take a short break. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. I'm talking with Lisa See, the author of Shanghai Girls, and we'll be right back. For more conversation with Lisa See about her latest novel, Shanghai Girls, which at this moment is number 6 on the bestseller list from the New York Times. You're careful to point out in the book that some of the characters are based on actual people. And I was so interested in the wealthy woman who decided to build Chinatown in Los Angeles to her own idea of how the Chinese live.
Right.
It was so poignant.
Right. So her name was Christine Sterling. Mm-hmm. She was a socialite who actually had started up here in the Bay Area and moved down there. And her first project was all Vera Street. I'm sure a lot of people have been there.
Right.
And, you know, it's supposed to be this authentic Mexican marketplace. Well, if you've been there, you know it's not very authentic.
No.
And so right across the street, she wanted to have this authentic Chinese city. It was one square block surrounded by a miniature Great Wall. And inside it was built from the leftover sets from the filming of The Good Earth. So it wasn't terribly authentic, but it did have a certain kind of charm, and tourists did love to go there. They'd ride on rickshaws, they'd nibble on China burgers, they'd go to the Chinese junk cafe and drink pirate grog, you know. So it was this kind of goofy place. And actually, just recently, people have started to send me photos. In fact, the other night, there was a man who had come to one of my book events. And when I was talking about China City, the next day he wrote to me and he said, you know, listening to you, I had to go through all of our family photographs. I had an Aunt Elizabeth. And we, you know, after she died, we had all of her photos, and we could never understand why there was this picture of her in a rickshaw, because she never went to China. And so he scanned it and sent it to me, and sure enough, it was definitely China City. And so now I just think these are kind of going to come out of the woodwork of these pictures of China City, because actually there isn't very much in the archives of China City.
Now, you lived in Chinatown yourself for a while, didn't
you? No, I never lived there, but my grandparents and great-aunts and uncles had a shop, a store there. And when I was a little girl, the family store was in what was left of China City. So China City was this kind of goofy place, but it was also ill-fated, and it closed after 10 years. But there was this one building that remained, and it was into that building that my family had their store.
Is it pretty much gone now?
Literally wiped off the physical map. Not a single brick left.
But there is a Chinatown.
There is. Yeah. So in 1938, there were four Chinatowns. Mm-hmm. And so China City was just one of them. Mm-hmm. And of those four, China City is completely gone. The City Market Chinatown, a little bit there. What's called New Chinatown is now called Old Chinatown, which tells you how old I'm getting to be. I can't believe that. And then I'm missing one, but in the original Chinatown. And there's just one little strip of buildings that are left.
Amazing. So that anyone who wanted to go and see Chinatown could still find something in
Los Angeles? They could still find something. And actually, the building that Pearl and May live in Shanghai Girls, is now the Chinese American Museum.
Okay. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. And my guest here in the studio is Lisa C. And we're talking about her latest book called Shanghai Girls. Two sisters, Pearl and May, who left Shanghai and came to America and lived for the, well, I was going to say for the rest of their lives. For the time that we read about in this book, they lived in Chinatown. And then you introduce a new generation, the daughter, Joy.
Right.
That is, it's wonderful because as soon as Joy appears, there's a you feel that things are going to change, at least for her, that she is sure to get out of Chinatown, and she's willful and spoiled and
all
wonderful.
Of those terrible things.
Yes, all those and of course all the family just dote on her. Mm-hmm. Tell the story of how she goes off to Chicago University. We'll skip her childhood and move directly.
Well,
to
she
that.
Does. You know, she certainly is the first in the family to go to college. Well, I guess her Pearl did go to college in China, but she is the first in this country to go to college, and. What can I say? I wouldn't want to say she falls in with the wrong crowd, but she does fall in with a politically not very wise crowd for that particular time.
Yeah.
And she has these ideas about what the People's Republic of China is like.
Yes.
And it's a very idealized version. And, of course, Pearl and May have come from there, so they have a very different idea of what it was like. Mm-hmm. And I do think that this is very reflective of that time period. So, you know, in the end, it's 1958. you know, and again, I'm just remembering, and I was only not old enough then really to remember, but certainly later, even into the 60s, how people had this idea. There were sort of two schools of thought about China. One is this is the enemy. It's a communist country. Yes. The domino theory, Korean War.
Right.
They're going to steal all of our nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. But there was also this other school of people in China are no longer starving. Everybody works so everybody eats. Women hold up half the sky. Women who are, you know, for the first time coming out of their houses, going to work, going to college. Mm-hmm. And the whole 1958, the whole idea of the communes, which started in that year, and what that meant for the country and how people also had this kind of idealized idea of China.
Yes.
And that, in some ways, was also right. You know, a lot of it turned out not to be right and have a terrible outcome. But in the moment, it seemed for many people like a great idea.
I was one of those people, and I just wouldn't hear a word against China. These people have, you know, they're building a paradise.
Right.
Barefoot doctors, as you say, women doing all these things. And I just simply could not listen to anyone who said, you know, there are dangers here and all this. You know, the end of the privatization of land and making everything communal may have consequences that are not beneficial. When I came to that part in the book, I thought, oh, I remember those days. I think we wanted China to thrive, and we wanted, China had been through such suffering. We wanted a paradise in China at last. And so I think we were gullible in that way, and we felt the Cultural Revolution was truly a revolution of culture.
But even before that, I think the sort of the, you know, centuries and millennia of starvation and famine, and, you know, and always raising money for the starving children in China, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea of everybody works so everybody eats was very appealing to many, many, many people. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, we can now look back and think, okay, Mao did a lot of terrible, really terrible things.
Yes.
But what he did for women was really, I mean, truly was revolutionary. And he's the first person who talked about equal pay for equal work. The first. And that's something that even today, you know, around the world, people are still struggling with, including in this country. So it was an interesting moment because it was so divided and all of the fears of communism and yet on the other side of, and which were, you know, in many cases completely legitimate, but also created that whole, you know, what happens when you think, oh, somebody's a communist and what can happen to that person and to that family and how devastating it can be.
And one of my favorite books is Balzac and the Little Chinese Seamstress. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a wonderful way to tell the story of you know, one tiny village swept up in the, and of course the movie I thought was beautiful of movies. One of your books is in the process of being filmed,
right?
And I forget which book it is.
It's Snowflower and the Secret Fan.
Snowflower.
Is being filmed right now outside of Shanghai.
Wonderful.
In a small studio that has all these sets for villages and things like that.
Oh, lovely. It must be so exciting to know that that's going on as we speak.
Well, it's exciting, but, you know, I go to a lot of movies myself. And so how often have you come out and you say, oh, but, you know, the book was so much better. And always, you know, we always do that.
Yes.
And so, you know, I have read the script. It is different from the book. A director has different visions, and it's a director's medium. So I'm looking forward to seeing it, but I don't think anybody should expect a 100% faithful version.
Uh-huh. I read that you're planning a sequel to
For Shanghai Girls.
Shanghai
Girls. I'm working on it right now.
That's such good news. When I came to the end of that book, I said, there must be a sequel. I want to know what happens with Pearl and May and Joy and the rest of them.
But I hadn't really planned it that way. I mean, I really didn't plan it that way. And it just really came from, actually, the first person was my publisher, who said, there has to be a sequel. And I really fought against it. I was like, oh, but the end is a new beginning. That's great. I like how it is. No, she just said, we have to have this. Everybody's going to want it. And sure enough, everyone has, except for one woman who wrote to me through my website who said, I really didn't like the end, and I want you to give me my money back. And I was like, well, I'm sorry you didn't like the end, but, you could try taking it back to the bookstore. I didn't know what else to say.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm sure that most of the letters you get are much more laudatory than...
really, most of them are. I really love the book, and please tell me there's going to be a sequel.
Yeah, because people love your work. And I mean that sincerely. There's a love of your characters and an admiration of the work that you put into it. You were a journalist at one point in your life.
Right.
What was that like to transition from journalism to novelist?
Well, the thing I think, and this is true for all kinds of writing, is if you can connect to the person,
yes,
whether real or imagined, that's all we want as readers. You want to be able, whether it's a celebrity or, some historical figure or, again, just a fictional creation, you want to be able to connect to them in a real emotional way. And that's what I try. I mean, I don't know that I'm always successful,
but
that's what I really try is to really connect to them as though I'm in the room with them when I'm writing. That's what I try to do, is just be in the room. And I think what happens, and again, I just speak for myself as a reader and the books that I love as a reader.
Yes.
It's when I can connect to the characters, again, whether real or imagined, and by extension what you're doing is connecting to your own life, connecting to the human condition.
Yes, and I haven't had things happen to me that happened to Pearl and May, and yet I feel so close to them and so with them that I know it's your skill as the writer that accomplishes that. And at first I wondered why you were writing in the first person as Pearl, but I trust the writer, and I kept going, and I ceased to think about it by the time I turned three pages. And then I think it worked beautifully because you're right inside her head.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, actually. When I was first writing the book, it was, and the other thing you left out is it's first person in the present tense, which is a very odd way to write a book.
Yes.
But when I was writing it, I had it in the second person in the past tense. Mm-hmm. And every day I would start out second person, past tense, and by the end of the day it would be in the first person, present tense. And it just went on this way, day after day after day. And I was about 100 pages in, and I had some little trip, book trip tour kind of thing that I had to do, and I printed out that first amount, and I just thought, and as I looked at it, I just kept thinking, God, this is so weird. I can't, what is wrong with me? I can't stay in the voice, in the time, in the tense. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to take the first chapter, and I'm going to do it the way Pearl wants it. First person, present tense. And I sent it to my editor, and he said, well, not a lot of books are written this. I mean, there are a lot of books in the first person, but not a lot that are in that present tense.
That's right.
And he said, but, I like it. So why don't you keep going? And as soon as I was able to do that and just let her talk the way she wanted to, Pearl, the character, this fictional character, but who's in my head,
well,
the way she wanted
all.
To. The book was so easy, I didn't have to fight anymore. But in the beginning, I was fighting so hard against what she wanted. And I don't know how many people listening know Chinese, but the thing with Chinese is that the language itself is in the present tense. It's a very difficult language to learn, but it does have one saving grace, which is you don't have to learn all the tenses. And you add date words. You add yesterday, today, tomorrow, 10,000 years in the future, 10,000 years in the past. The actual verb itself is always in the same tense. And in that present tense. So it's like, 5,000 years from now, I walk down the street. It's not I will walk down
Amazing.
The street. And so I think that was part of it, was that when I thought of her speaking English or Chinese, I heard it in the present tense.
Has that ever happened with your writing before, that a character insisted upon presenting
like
herself that.
That
way?
Nothing like that before. I mean, when I started Snowflower and the Secret Fan, and I had gone to China, and I had done all of this research mm-hmm. there, and I was in this very, very remote area, and it was a hard trip. Let's just say this. I'm not a camper. Okay. I like hot water, you know, I like to have a lock on the door, I like sheets and things like that. I'm not a camper. So it was a tough trip. And on my way out, I had one night in the city of Guilin, which is a pretty nice tourist city, beautiful city, actually. Yeah. And I was in this, you know, got to take a shower and all things like that. But I was in the room and I had this voice in my head and it was so strong. And it was a little bit of my grandmother, a little bit of my great aunt, and a little bit of this woman I had met in Jianyong County, who was a 96-year-old bound-footed woman who used the secret writing. And I had gotten to interview her. And so I had this voice. It was so persistent. Now I realize I'm sounding like I'm like bipolar or something. But it was so persistent in my head that I pulled out my laptop and I wrote the first chapter of Snowflower and the Secret Fan. And her voice was there, you know, it was just so strong. And that's when I knew I had a book, because actually, when I went there, I didn't know that I was going to write a book. I just thought, I am so obsessed with this secret writing that I've just got to go find out about it. And I, you know, I don't know what will happen, but I've got to find out about it. And then Lily's voice was just so strong. So I think that that's actually a real key thing. It's just, as a writer, are you willing to listen?
Yes.
And when with Shanghai Girls, I really fought it. Mm-hmm. I just really fought it.
And are you willing to set reason aside, or in your part of your mind says this can't be happening, and you just need to go with it and listen to that voice and get it down? Because
somebody, then hope that it's working.
You know? Somebody wants that story told, mm-hmm. and you're the one that's going to tell it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's magic.
Well, and I think that is the part of writing that is magic. I don't know where that comes from. I mean, so that's why I do think of it like magic.
There's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Lisa, I'm so appreciative you're taking the time. You're so generous with your time, and it's wonderful to meet you and talk with you. And I'm sure that our listeners will be on their way to the bookstore within 20 minutes if they don't already have a copy of Shanghai Girls.
Well, and thank you so much for having me and for all your wonderful questions.
And I want to urge people to go to Lisa's website and to get the complete list of her writings, because there's an amazing variety of things that she's written throughout her career. And, of course, those of us who are old-timers remember Lisa's mother, Carolyn C., who's still with us, of course, and still writing, but was such an important part of the women's movement in this country. And her works are equally valuable to us. And it's wonderful that there are two generations of you writing this wonderful material.
I wouldn't be a writer if not for her.
She's a marvel. Mm-hmm. Yes. Lisa, it's been such a privilege to spend time with you and talk with you about your work, particularly about Shanghai Girls, your most recent novel. So thank you so much for your generosity in spending the time with us during your very busy book tour. I want also to thank Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and tell you a little bit about next month's show. Next month, as you may already know, is Sonoma County Reads, a part of the Big Reads Project. And Sonoma County Reads features the work of Mark Twain, specifically Tom Sawyer. And while Twain is best known for his novels of life on the Mississippi River, these are only a small part of his lifetime of work. And we thought you might like to hear some of his earlier work here in California. Yes? Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain, came to California. Surely you remember the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County. Incidentally, that was not one of Clemens' favorites. Here's what he wrote to his mother about that frog. Quote, "To think that after writing many an article, a man might be excused for thinking tolerably good, that those New York people should single out a villainous backwoods sketch to compliment me on." Unquote. Here to talk about his California work will be Jonah Raskin, a celebrated writer himself. And together, Jonah and I will talk about Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain, about his California sojourn, as recorded in Ruffagit and in short stories. And you can hear that program on Wednesday evening, April 14th at 7 on KRCB. And so we say goodnight to all of you readers out there, reminding you that it was Jack London who may have been the first to say, "There's no such thing as too many books."
Recommended Reading for Small Peeps by Stephanie Friel. As with any Jan Brett book, adults and children reading Daisy Comes Home will escape into the detailed, graceful, and fanciful artwork, this time lush and colorful China. In the middle of the night, Daisy, the smallest chicken, loved by her owner but taunted by the other hens, is unexpectedly swept away by the rising Li River. After surviving near escapes from monkeys, water buffalo, and an opportunistic fisherman, Daisy's rescued by her spirited owner, a young girl named Mei Mei. After her adventure, Daisy returns with self-assurance and proudly takes her place among the happy hens. Surrounded by striking artwork, Daisy Comes Home is a journey of growth and confidence.